This episode of I Ride a Bike is supported in part by Allspeed, the official bike shop of the podcast. With convenient locations in Portland, Bethel, and Carrabassett Valley, Maine, Allspeed is the local shop for everything bike. For more information and to check out their latest hot deals, please visit allspeed.com. Hi, I'm Seth Ballier, the host of I Ride a Bike, where each episode we follow one basic premise: to never grow old, one ride at a time, and the stories that follow.
Take me back to the times when we would grab our bikes and ride the days into the night. Though our eyes would soon be open for the moment we were golden.
Welcome to the podcast. Today I'm down in Amherst, New Hampshire. I've taken a beautiful spring sunny day drive down this way. Amazing little cute little town going through. But anyway, I was lucky enough to track down Ken Avery, our mutual friend, Bo, who you've heard on a previous episode, connected us, and he invited me down to his spot here. And thanks for having me sitting here at your studio at your place.
Yeah, man. Thanks for announcing my address to everybody.
Yeah, we can beep that out. I was literally looking over at you. Maybe I want to say it.
The funny thing is, no one cares. Yeah, it's totally right. Cool. Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. And I've been listening to all your podcasts. I think what you're doing is super cool. I do a lot of these talking about like super technical stuff, but to be able to do one just to talk about like why we all ride is, I think, super special.
Yeah, right on. Exactly. And that's the angle I'm trying to go for. I'm learning so much about bikes as I do these podcasts. If you've listened to any of them, you know that I don't know a whole lot about the details, the nitty-gritty of bikes, but I love riding them. So that's what I'm going to try to pull out of this conversation. And so let's start off with why do you ride a bike?
I knew this question was coming. I meant to rehearse an answer for you, but I didn't really. So I'm just going to kind of wing it. You know, you meet a lot of people along the way. It's super fun. There's a fluidity about riding a bike and kind of seeing things along the way that you don't see when you're driving a car or even taking a walk necessarily. I grew up skateboarding, and one of my buddies growing up skateboarding is a guy named Andrew Etter, and he grew really tall really fast, and his knees were pretty weak. And so a doctor told him to stop skateboarding and get on a bike. And I was amazed at the ground we could cover as kids riding a bike, and it opened up this sense of freedom and adventure. And so he got a mountain bike, this newfangled thing called a mountain bike, in like 1990, right? And I was riding like this old Schwinn 10-speed that I found in like this old garage. And so I don't know if I was gravel riding or not, but it might have been ahead of my time. But anyway, we were basically mountain biking in the 90s, and it opened my eyes to kind of just seeing the world in a different way, getting a health benefit without even realizing it or meaning to. And then just, you know, kind of, I don't know, taking it all in a different way. I don't know how else to say it, really. I don't really have a good answer for you. I wish I did.
I think that's the perfect answer.
Yeah. it's just fun, and it's good for you. And the scene is fun. People are always having a good time. Right. So that's why I ride a bike.
I tell you, if they're not having fun while riding a bike, then you're definitely doing it wrong somehow.
I agree.
Unless they're just stuck in traffic somewhere, sucking down car exhaust. Maybe that's not that'd be the least fun part of riding a bike, possibly. So where did you grow up then? From New England originally, or?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town called East Lyme, Connecticut, which is sort of like, I don't know, west of Mystic, kind of by the beach. And it was kind of like a little beach town and kind of sleepy suburbia. And I was always drawn to action sports. And you can't really surf on Long Island Sound. And I couldn't get out to like Rhode Island to go surfing at a young age. So I got into skateboarding, and then we just started building ramps. And we would just build like launch ramps, and my buddy had a half pipe, and we would just kind of say, like, I wonder if I can do this or that, and just try it until you did it. And at a very early age, it was kind of formative in that way. It was also in the 80s counterculture, you know? And so it wasn't necessarily cool to be a skater kid in coastal Connecticut, you know? Right, and, right. and So it taught you a lot of lessons about like, hey, this is good, healthy fun. There's nothing wrong with this. I don't care. Like I'm going to do this and you're not hurting anything. And you know, it taught me from an early age to kind of think outside the box. And then as I kind of mentioned a minute ago, my buddy kind of got me on a bike from there. So.
Like what age was that? Was that your first bike then? Was the, when you got this bike after skating?
It was a Bridgestone MB5 1991 from Wayfarer Bicycle in New London, Connecticut. It was my first proper bike. Yeah. I mean, I had like, you know, your department store bikes and all that stuff. And then like the hand-me-down kind of like, you know, junkers. But this was like the first like, whoa, this is like a legit, you know, $300 bicycle at the time. I was like, this is amazing, you know?
Right,
and like, I literally like polished that thing and slept with it practically. I mean, it was super special and really kind of changed my life in that way. Just because you could kind of, like I was saying earlier, you could like kind of go anywhere. And little did I know, there just happened to be like a lot of trails in that area. And there were some developments going on as well. So like we would kind of poach these developments and find these big sand hills and like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was like, it's like that scene in Gleaming the Cube where they're like in the warehouse, yep. Like, and they're totally just like trying to, anyway, but it's funny. We would just find these construction sites and like, say, I wonder if I can like ride up or down that huge pile of sand that's like 30 feet tall or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're on this like, you know, bike that like the brakes don't really work on 26-inch 1.9 tires or whatever. And you'd fall and get dirty and laugh about it and do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a, I still have that mentality when I see a giant pile of dirt or sand or anything like that down the road from us is one of the trailheads for the Eastern Trail.
Yeah.
And there's a development going on now and they have these giant piles of landfill or fill for the land or whatever. And giant sign right at the entrance of it, no biking, and it's like yelling at me almost,
right.
Because I'm looking at it and we're getting on our bikes to head down the trail, but all I want to do is just cruise around that, you know, the giant dug holes and these giant hills of dirt, and you know, just laughing at me.
There's that inherent like, why do they want me to stay out of there thing, right? And it's like, you know, we as like, you know, 40 something whatever, and I like we still kind of giggle about it, but at the end of the day, like, you know, growing up, it was something that was an adventure, you know, and you'd also like kind of find a trail and say, where does this trail take me in the woods? And like, sometimes it would be like a 6-hour ride because you really didn't know and you didn't have any like supplies with you or anything, but that's kind of part of the adventure. And that's part of still what is alluring about, you know, being on a bike today.
Yep. Absolutely. So then do you adventure a lot on that bike then?
Oh my God. I went all over town. I went all over to like the surrounding towns. Like I used to ride my bike from East Lyme to New London to go to work, my first job and stuff. And, you know, I didn't realize, but I was putting in a lot of miles.
Yeah,
and so, about 6 months after, there was a race that was in the next town over. It was called the Meadow Muffin Madness. It was like amazing name, right?
Seriously, I just pictured the poster and it makes me hungry for some reason.
Yeah, I know. There's like a cow riding on it. It's like hilarious. But anyway, it was like a pretty well-known race. It was part of the New England Championship Series. And, you know, one of my neighbors brought me to it as an eighth grader, you know, so two things about this really quick. So I happen to live down the street from a couple guys who were like hardcore mountain bikers in the really early days of riding. It's not like it is now where like everybody kind of has a mountain bike. Everybody knows about mountain biking. It's kind of like mainstream in a way now. Back then it was like Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, you mountain bike? Like where do you ride? Like, and it was like instantly like this like club that you were in. And it didn't matter, like any of the other things didn't matter. It was like, cool, you ride, like we'll ride together. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so they all kind of like went to this like little coffee shop in East Lyme called Moose Hopper. So it was like a guy named Walter Iwanicki, Bill Humphreys, Terry Doherty, Jeff Taylor. And the owner of Moose Hopper was a guy named Kurt. Kurt Stiles. And so they all rode together. And so Walt's house was right down the street from my parents. Jeff Taylor was right next door. Terry was around the corner. And like every Tuesday night, they would get the hall pass and they would go mountain biking. So like these, you know, at the time they were like early 30s. I thought they were so old, right? I'm 13. I'm like, oh, these old guys are rad, you know? But like really, really, they were just like, you know, adults and, yeah. and they got the hall pass on a Tuesday night to like have a group ride. And, for whatever reason, they took me under their wing and showed me trails. They would drive me to places and like, you know, show me these trails, show me these events, show me how to ride in a way. And without those guys, that support system, I don't know that I would have stayed with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was super special. And, they showed me the first, like, you can be a lifestyle mountain biker, I guess is probably the best way I would say it.
And they were fully welcoming for a 13-year-old to come riding along, and they were, or were you the lackey that they just gave shit to the entire time?
I mean, dude, if you think I talk a lot now, you should have met teenager Ken, because yeah. honestly, like, it was, I was definitely like, I thought I was pretty cool and stuff. So anyway, but yeah, and they were very patient is yeah. bottom line, you know, like, and the fact that, like I was saying, back then, it was kind of like the fact that there was another mountain biker. They were like, they kind of had to let me in. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And so it was...
You had the membership card. There you go.
Totally. Like, don't talk about Fight Club, but like, we're all in Fight Club. Yep. You know what I mean? And so it was kind of... it was a special thing. And I'm like super grateful to them. And I still talk to most of them to this day. On one of those rides, this is hilarious. So we're riding, and so Bill Humphreys was one of those guys, and he's like probably in his 50s at this point. So he was like older than those 30-year-olds. So this guy was like ancient, right? So at the time, in my mind, as a 13-year-old kid, but he was so strong and he was hanging. And I literally said to him, like, wow, this is so cool. Like, how long have you been riding? Just like as a kid, like not knowing what to say, right? And one of the first things Bill ever said to me was, back when I used to coach the kids, you know, so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, who are the kids? And he goes, Greg LeMond and Davis Finney.
Oh, no way.
And I go, are you kidding me right now? And I didn't know, but he, you know, had been like a national team coach. And Bill was also like a super high-end road racer for many years. He Amazing. Was one of the first Americans to go to Europe to race. And he just happened to be on this group ride. So like, you know, the universe sometimes puts you in front of certain people. And I think this is going to be a thread through this whole discussion today because, dude, I have so many stories to tell
right
you.
Right on, yeah. Well, that's pretty amazing. I mean, that's amazing right there from the start. Did you know who Greg LeMond was?
Yeah, at, man, that time? Of course. Okay, yeah, like, right, you yeah. know, like, you know, front of the Wheaties box, right? right I mean, sure. like, he was like, this is, you know, I'm talking like 1991. Mm-hmm. So, like, he was still relevant. But, I mean, he was, like, such a rock star, like, late 80s and stuff and that whole era. And, obviously, he's still super prominent. But, I mean... at the time, you know, he was still like, I would say at the height. And so, I was just so stunned. And, it was like the first kind of person who like had a connection into the biz in a way. Mm-hmm. And, so I've always been thankful to Bill and he's always a character. We'll still stay in touch. He still gives me advice whether I want it or not. and I love that guy. So, anyway, always thankful.
I mean, so some of the best advice you can get is the stuff you don't necessarily want, but then later reflect and say, yeah, that was really good advice, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, honestly, like, this is so crazy. I was at Cyclocross Worlds, like, about a couple months ago, and the winner of that race was Marion Vos, and I was there working with the Dutch team through a connection through the tire company I work for, and... anyway, she gave me a jersey for my daughter, Tessa, and she signed it and it's framed upstairs in my house. And, but Bill was like, dude, before you frame that, put it on your daughter and like, have her feel the power. And we did. And it was like magic. And it was something that I probably wouldn't have taken that moment to do. But like it hit my daughter when she put that jersey on. I was like, whoa. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so she, you know, your daughter races as well. So it was an extra deep connection there.
Yeah, yeah. Huge, huge. And so, and all of that comes from like, you know, these people I still keep in touch with. I got to see Walt out in Sedona at the festival, a couple months ago. And so, yeah, it's great to kind of still be in touch. And that's also a thread here that you'll see, like, I don't know what it is about the bike scene, but like you just meet people that you always keep in touch with and like, you make friends for life. Everybody has that lifestyle. Everybody's in it for the same reason. And it's unlike anything else I've ever experienced.
Yeah, absolutely. So then now you're riding with, this crew on yeah. Tuesday nights. And then what was the next sort of phase of your riding?
Well, so like I did that Metamuffin Madness race and I was like, whoa, there's a lot of people that do this, you know, like that was like a big race in the 90s. And the 90s was like, it wasn't first wave of mountain biking, but it was the first big wave. Mm-hmm. You know, it was when really people started hearing about it and people were like trying it out and stuff. And so these like New England Championship Series races, there was like a lot of people at those. And, you know, the beginner class was just like open class, like all age groups. It was like, you know, 100 something people or whatever. And you know, it was, they did like a Le Mans style start. So you had to like run to your bike, pick it up and then get on it and then start. It
madness, was madness, like pure madness,
total madness. And it, with all like the good 90s sprinkled in too, just like everybody's like, you know, just ridiculous and the whole thing. So
beautiful, but flash of fluorescent everywhere. And yeah,
like, yeah, silly patterns, the whole thing. I mean, you know, the sport was trying to find its identity as much as all the people were, you mm-hmm. know, and as was I in that way. And so I started working at Wayfarer Bike Shop. A guy named Bob Harrington hired me to talk too much about bikes all day long when I was in high school. So Bob saw that there was a little group of kids from East Lyme who were really serious about this. And he started the Wayfarer Junior team. And so we used to go around to all of the, you know, New England Series races and just try to throw down. And so it was a guy named Matt Jameson, who was a couple of years older than me. It was Tom Danielson, who became a World Tour rider later in life. Neil Clausen and myself. And, you know, so just kind of like ragtag group of kids, yeah. You know, like, but we all, you know, started winning.
And you were wearing logo jerseys and feeling like you were in the mix, but now the Fight Club had become just a bigger club, right?
Yeah. This was like, this was the first time that I was like, wow, I'm on a team I want to be on. And this is like who I want to become and stuff. And I really kind of felt that for the first time. And, you know, Bob was like super gracious to like deal with us, to be quite honest. And, but you know, we raced all over New England. We raced at some World Cups and some national level races as well that happened to be within a driving distance. Mm-hmm. And then through that, you know, there was this race at Mount Snow. There was a national and World Cup race, and there was another one, Hunter Mountain. I have another story about that one in a minute, but I got to tell this story really quick. So, dude, this is like, you know, through this whole process, I like got my driver's license, and now I'm like, wow, I can like drive to other places to ride, and that was special, right? And so, dude, I get my license, and Mount Snow had like this snow slalom race, which was like at the end of the ski season. They try to figure out a way to like start bringing the mountain bikers to the mountain, right? And yep. They do this like ridiculous like dual slalom on snow on bikes, right? And so like I had got my license like 3 days before. I'm like driving I don't know why my parents let me drive to Vermont, like in the mm-hmm. you know, like from Connecticut to, and I have no idea as a 16 year. But anyway, so for whatever reason, Matt Jameson was like, yeah, sure. Like, I'll go with you. I'm like, all right, cool. So we hop in. I had this like old rusted out Toyota pickup truck that I used to like polish around the rust holes, you know?
Yeah, right. Totally.
And like, it was amazing. And so we're driving up and I'm like super psyched. I can't wait. It's like the first mountain bike race of the season. I'm like, you know,
it's the first one you've driven to yourself too and everything,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Full on,
like so many firsts, yeah. Right? Like this experience with this happening. So I pick him up at like, you know, 5 a.m. and we're like trying to get up there. And so on the way up, I get pulled over.
of course, right?
You know, and
can't go perfectly smoothly the first time.
No, absolutely not. And Matt's like, oh man, I should have been looking out. I'm like, I'm gonna die. Like, I am dead. Like, should I just go home at this point? You know what I mean? Like, I'm totally in trouble. And so we go up to Mount Snow, and I ended up winning the race. And,
oh, you did? All right.
Which is hilarious, yeah. Right? And so I drive home and drop Matt off, and there's no cell phones, you know, right. Like, and hell no was I gonna like try to explain this over a phone call from a payphone, right? So I was like, all right, so I'm just gonna drive home. And so I roll in, and my parents are waiting for me at home, and they're like, how'd it go? And I'm like, well, I got pulled over, but I won the race. And they're like, so my dad goes, you got pulled over? And my mom goes, but you won the race. I was like, so what does that mean? You know, and it was like, of course, like whatever, first offense, like you're gonna pay the ticket and the whole thing was like insurance and the whole, what a pain. But anyway, but it was like such an experience, you know what I mean? And it was like, again, just a story from the road. So, and we were on that, again, we were on that little Wayfarer team. So it was like the first race we were even going to with this. And it was just, the whole thing was coming together, and there's always bumps in the road, but I guess that's why we're talking, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's really right. So, and then your parents then, I mean, winning the race probably did help, you know, ease the whole getting a ticket thing a little bit, maybe.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, you know, but at the end of the day,
well, how fast were you going? What was the actual ticket?
I think I was going like 78 and a 55.
Okay. So that's a little bit, yeah.
But you were pumped up.
Dude,
I was super pumped. I was trying to tell the cop, like, I'm going to a mountain bike race. It's cool. And the cop's like, yeah, I don't care, dude. But like, I'm surprised my Toyota truck would go 78. It was like a little four banger, like two-wheel drive, like 87 Toyota pickup truck. But anyway, you know, whatever. We must have been going downhill or something. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, man, Mount Snow was like the Super Bowl for New England mountain biking for many years. I mean, there was a World Cup. And there was a national, and sometimes they would do both in the same weekend. I mean, one year, I remember like Lance Armstrong at the height of his career came and he raced a mountain bike race there at that event. There was 25,000 people there. You know, I mean, it's interesting to be able to compete as a teenager at an event where there's 25,000 people.
That's pretty mind blowing. Yeah.
It's not like it's not your little league game. It's another aspect, yeah. You know? And so.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was going to ask you if at any time in there you decided that, you know, maybe you'd look at road biking racing at all, but it sounds like the more technical, you're heading the other direction from cross country towards more gnarly riding.
You know, the Wayfarer team lasted for a couple of years, and Tom ended up going towards road. Jeremy Powers was another guy who was from East Lyme, who I have to mention. And he wasn't on the Wayfarer team because by the time we were kind of up and running, he was already like on another team because the kid was so fast. Jeremy ended up winning multiple national cyclocross titles as a pro. Okay. He's very well known. He's a commentator on GCN and stuff sometimes as well. There's a guy named Richard Fries who was like a race announcer, and he always used to joke, like, what's in the water in East Lyme? It's like a town of, like, you know, at the time it was like 5,000 people or whatever, right? And there's like four kids who turned pro, like, out of the same little area right there.
And that's pretty amazing, yeah.
So it was, you know, it's kind of, Richard still says that to me, and there's kind of an asterisk next to one of those names. But anyway, I'll just leave that there. But you know, through being exposed to like all these pros and stuff, you meet people, and you know, like I met a lot of the New England pros, but being at like a World Cup or a national level event, you'd meet like all the people from the West Coast or from Europe. And so back in the day, like, I'm so old, dude. I'm so Uncle Rico right now. I don't mean...
When you could ride over that mountain real quick?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Right. Yeah, yeah, right. Could have won states. Yeah. So, you know, there was cross country and there was downhill, and then there was a dual slalom event. Mm-hmm. And dual slalom was actually my favorite event. Because every single run is head-to-head racing. Like, how cool. It's like by design, right? And you can run any bike. You don't have to have a special bike. You can. It's just like a 30-second race, mm-hmm. and as hard as you can. And so the caveat here is that there was a junior class in the cross country and in downhill, but in dual slalom, it was just open class. So
is that just because of lack of interest in it or something? So they had to like boost the numbers? Or?
Yeah, it was a qualifier event.
Okay.
So you had to basically qualify for top 32 spots at this national. And it was kind of like then a, you know, an elimination round type scenario, like most dual slalom races are. So to open it up and to kind of ratchet up the competition a bit, they just always kept dual slalom open class. So as an idiot 16-year-old, I was like, oh, I'm going to go up there and try to qualify in the pro class. Like, so, you know, I'm there trying to like ride some practice laps on this dual slalom course. And this is, you realize this is like 1994, right? So mm-hmm. like we had like inner tubes and 26-inch wheels and suspension that didn't really work and stuff like that. And, now in dual slalom, if you miss your qualifying run, you're DQ'd, like you're done. You missed your qualifier, like you're out, right? So like 5 minutes before qualifiers were going to start, I somehow pinched a tire. Sorry, pinched a tube, rather. And so I'm like, you know, freaking out, running down the course as a teenager at Mount Snow. Like we drove from Connecticut all the way up there. I'm like, man, I need to find an inner tube right now. I'm like, I hope that like shop at the bottom is open. Like I didn't have any cash on me. I'm like, you know, literally like
freaking out.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Like, so I'm like 15 years old, probably some, maybe 16, something like that. And like, this pro, was like, hey kid, do you need an inner tube? And I was like, oh my God, like, you know, this person was kind of famous. And I was just like so stunned. And I'm like, yeah, I need an inner tube. So she gave me one. And I was able to put this inner tube in and not qualify anyway. So it didn't even matter. But
you just got your run in. So
I got my runs in. I will say this, like as that 16-year-old kid getting my runs in, I was able to still like, you know, I still was able to beat this some pro dude who I don't even know who, like in 2 qualifier runs. It was like that to me was like a rush and a win for me, just to like to be even like remotely competitive. But the friendship that I made in that moment was like life changing. And so that person was Kathy Sessler, and she runs the Santa Cruz Syndicate downhill team as their team manager now. And,
wow.
And
yeah.
At the time she was Masters downhill world champion. So, you know, and she just was a nice person who gave me an inner tube. And as people do, like in the mountain bike world, hey, you need a tube, here it is. You need a patch kit, whatever. Like, you know, it still happens today, right? And a lot of people don't think much of it. But it like completely saved my whole trip and weekend in that way. And
so how did you reconnect with it? So she just gave you, I'm trying to put myself in the scenario. So you're running down the hill looking for an inner tube. She just raises her hand and said, here you go. Then how did you reconnect with her after that?
Yeah. So basically like, you know, I made my parents drive me to a bike shop after, and we bought her an inner tube and found her at the event and handed it to her. And,
oh, right on.
And she's like, she appreciated the gesture just mm-hmm. just to be grateful, you know, but she's like, kid, I ride for a tire company. Like, yeah, I have as many suits as I want, you know what I mean? So like, and it was kind of a hilarious thing, but, she was like, you know, what other races are you doing? And I was like, well, you know, my dream is to go to Mammoth to race the Kamikaze downhill, which was at the time the most notorious downhill course in the world, probably. You could get up to about 50 miles an hour going down a fire road on a 90s mountain bike.
Yeah.
And so
that's no joke. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and so she's like, you're going to die using those like Velociraptors or whatever you had for tires, you know? And so she sent me, some of the first Maxxis downhill tires ever made. The company she rode for was Maxxis. And so, you know, Maxxis back then wasn't what it is now. It was kind of this like, you know, unknown brand that existed in other industries essentially. And so, but I was so blown away, the fact that like I met somebody famous and that like, you know, they were nice, and they cared to help a normal kid out.
Right.
That I literally started like carving little sipes into these tires with like a razor blade in my hands and like, drawing tire treads in like the margins of my like notes in school. I would sit in study hall and like, you know, dream about like, what if we did this or that, you know? Cause it was like, it was a formative time in the sport. There was new suspension designs like every year. The sport was definitely like in flux, and as were tires and braking systems and suspension and all this other things, you know, like geometry still is going on. Right. But like, this time in particular was like, just a, you know, kind of a right place, right time moment. And for whatever reason, I could just feel it. And so, I would literally, this is before email. Like, so like I was like faxing her sketches that I would do. And she's like, dude, what is your problem?
You know
what
I mean? Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to picture this scenario. Like, I mean, of all things to start drawing are these, you know, detailed, you know, sort of, technical illustrations of tires.
Yeah. It's bizarre.
She clearly had a large influence on you in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, I was just like, how do I emulate this lifestyle?
Mm-hmm.
And it was like those people from Moose Hopper that I met. It was like the people from the bike shop that I met. How do I do this all the time? You know, kids are under a lot of pressure, man. Mm-hmm. You know, kids, like they go to school and like, you know, unfortunately for most kids, the takeaway is like, you know, you better go to school and get a job. And it's like, dude, that's not life, man. That's not how it's supposed to be.
Right.
So, I really wanted to like, I don't know if it was from skateboarding growing up or what, but I really wanted to get out of that
mm-hmm.
and like not sit in a cubicle and just, you know, be able to like channel my passion for this in a way that, you know, could be what I do. And so I don't know why, but I just started like having ideas because I was so obsessed with it. And for whatever reason, she was nice enough to say, these are some decent ideas. And and so like she started sending my drawings to the company, and they started sending me tires to test when I was in high school.
Based on some of your drawings? Or wow, no kidding.
And,
wow.
And at the time, like, you know, I was coming up as a racer and I was doing okay, but mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like I was super dominant or anything. I mean, I was lucky enough to get on the podium occasionally and mm-hmm. stuff. And, but I mean, it was, you know, they saw, you know, they could look me up in Norba News, right? Which is back in the day. So Norba used to be the National Off-Road Bicycling Association, and then they were kind of like absorbed by USA Cycling eventually. But back in the day, they would send you like a quarterly like magazine, and they would rank everybody regionally. And so, you know, they'd have like, you know, 500 kids ranked from New England, and, right. and the Wayfarer kids would usually be, you know, in the top five or so. And so I was lucky to kind of be at enough events where I could get enough points to where, you know, and then meet some people this way. And it just, you know what it is, man, it's just all about being thankful. And, it's just like in that moment, I could have been like, again, thanks for the tires. See you later. You know what I mean? But I just wanted to show her that I was so grateful and that like, I just wanted to learn more. You know, afterwards, like I started just kind of racing in college and stuff. I went to UMass Amherst, they have like a huge cycling team. And I just remember like going like on move-in day at UMass, and like you're in this like 10x10 dorm room that you're sharing. And I got like two bikes, you know. My roommate's like stoked, you know, like awesome. Like you're gonna bring in like all that crap and like wear spandex
right, sweet, all the time,
right? Sweet, you know. But I mean, immediately you had a group of friends like, you know, mountain bike dorks to go ride with and like find trails with and have that whole experience with. And it was like a little safety, you mm-hmm. know? And then the ruckus really began, because first of all, UMass is a bit of a party school, but it's beyond that. It's just collegiate cycling was like, you know, ratcheting it up another level, but we were just complete idiots. Oh my God. It was so funny. So like we went to the school and we're like, all right, we're going to hold a cross country event, which is, you know, already been kind of going on for a couple of years. A guy named Dan Cody kind of started this race at UMass and ran it. And I was like, what if we did a dual slalom race on Orchard Hill? Like, this would be so sick. And so there's this hill that goes right down to a dorm, so like everybody can watch it. And right. there had never been a dual slalom race in the Eastern Conference before. And there was one at Collegiate National Championship. So I was like, we should do our own. So me and Marty Walsh go to like, the school to be like, hey, can we borrow your Bobcat? Right? Like, right. Like totally
tear up your campus.
And, right. Yeah. Is that cool? And they're like, they don't want to say no because they didn't want to like, you know, totally like they saw how psyched we were, but they definitely don't want to say yes. You right. know what I mean? So like,
fair enough.
Right. Right. So they're like, well, we would let you use the Bobcat, but you know, we're using it for another project. And I'm like, so like totally dumb and dumber. So you're telling me there's a chance, right? Yeah, right. So I'm like, we, for whatever reason in our, you know, I don't know, overly ambitious, like stupor, basically went to like Taylor Rental and rented a like bulldozer. Like, I'm not talking like not a Bobcat. Yeah. Like we rented a bulldozer and towed it to campus with my truck in August, right before school started. Okay. Okay.
Is this the same Toyota that you had?
This is, yeah. It's okay. A 4-cylinder Toyota truck towing. Well, I don't understand why Taylor Rental let us do this. Like, just side note. But anyway, it was amazing. We talked our way into it.
They saw it as an insurance claim about to happen.
Yeah. They're like, we need a new one of these machines. Yeah, right. We'll let these kids take this thing. So we tow it to Orchard Hill. We don't know how to use this machine, okay? Like, we've never used right. like a machine like this before. This is like a Tonka truck, massive bulldozer yeah. with like, you know.
It isn't saying that they let you just take it.
Yeah, this has like the scoop bucket on the back yeah. and the whole thing. So So we drive it up there. We didn't, you know, there's those like stabilizer arms on the side. We didn't know you were supposed to use it. We almost flipped the thing.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't have a dig safe. We're digging next to like the main power that goes to the dorms. Okay. Like how we didn't die, I don't know. So, and so me and Marty are sitting there like trying to like dig this dual slalom course, and a cop pulls up, and the cop literally is in the parking lot and just looks up the hill. And you see him look down and kind of shake his head. And then he drove away. And I'm like, okay, either he thinks we're legit and we have a permit and stuff.
We're back with a SWAT team.
or we're really in trouble, right? And so for whatever reason, he never came back. And so we made this like sick dual slalom course. It had these like huge berms and like double jumps and stuff and like a big booter at the end. And like, and it's fully like on campus. And like, so we do the race and, let me back up because we almost didn't do the race. So we get a call from campus like about a week later and they're like, yeah, dude, you're those kids, huh? And I'm like, yeah, but you said we could, but it was just busy or whatever. And the guy was like, yeah, no, you didn't dig that by hand. And he's like, he starts telling us about like the dig safe. And I'm like, oh no. And so we apologize. He let us keep the race, actually. Yeah. He let us do the race. And it became the first dual slalom race ever in Easter Conference. And we still did the cross country. And they still run this race to this day. I don't know if they still have the slalom course up, but UMass Cycling still runs a race there and stuff. So, but again, it was just like, you know, sometimes you just can't stop the passion, you know?
You can't, yeah, for sure, yeah. Well, let's take a quick water break, and then we'll come back and we'll get into what you're doing these days and go from there.
Sounds good,
man. So we'll be back right after these messages.
There's a legend about the race between Medicine Mike and the guy who rode the Baja Bike. That's Baja by Murray, that thumb-shifting 10-speed with pro-style cantilever brakes, all-terrain tires, and the grit to get you from timber to town. They raced from the hills to the center of town, and when Medicine Mike finally settled down, he said, "Don't think I was racing, son. I just wanted to see that Baja run." If a legend's what you're looking for, Murray gives you more.
Finally, the days of having dirt back under the tires is upon us. Well, maybe some mud and a few sketchy potholes, but it's spring, and I for one am stoked. And to get you ready for another great season, all you have to do is stop by AllSpeed's amazing new flagship store, conveniently located right off the Portland Trail System at 936 Brighton Avenue. In addition to a full range of bikes and accessories for riders of all levels, the super friendly staff at AllSpeed is ready to help with everything from your basic spring tune-up to a full custom build. And be sure to keep an eye out for a season of fun events, parties, and shenanigans. With convenient locations in Portland, Carrabassett Valley, and Bethel, Maine, AllSpeed is the local shop for everything bike. For more information and to check out their latest hot deals, please visit allspeed.com. AllSpeed, the official bike shop of the podcast. All right, and welcome back. Sitting here with Ken Avery. We're left off. You had just dug up half the campus, got away with it, and not only that, but then turned it into an amazing race course. So, what's next in the line?
Well, I mean, you know, from here it was just kind of more of the same for a little while. I mean, it kind of grew the team and kind of just more people riding around campus and stuff. So like, you know, at the student union, there's like these famous steps and you can kind of jump off the top of the center and like down like 20 stairs. And we started making that into a gap. And then like right next door, there's these two grass bumps that are like landscaped in and people used to kind of ride over them and kind of use them as dirt jumps. And then the school thought they'd be clever and like put these like boulders on top of each, which then became like a high jump contest. So we started dirt jumping over these like boulders, like in the middle of this like landscaped campus.
Can't keep you down. Yeah,
it was just hilarious. Like just and that was kind of like punk rock culture in mountain bike, and it was kind of like instead of skating and grinding, you know, like a rail or something, you were just looking for lines in around campus on your bike and kind of messing around that way. And and it was all in the fun, and we weren't ruining anything. It wasn't, I mean, we didn't mean it to be disrespectful. Although I will tell you, like, so I went into school as an engineering student, and I ended up switching to communication media. But at the time I was an engineer, and this like professor comes up and like grabs me like scruff of the neck kind of thing when I jump these boulders, because he was pissed because like they put these there so you're not supposed to be able to jump them, but like it just became a bigger challenge.
I'm picturing Mr. Hand from Spicoli and
1000%. Yeah. And so
was that like, his name was it Mr. Hand?
Yeah, it totally okay, was right. yeah aloha Mr. Hand. So yeah, so he grabs Spicoli here and he's like, what's your major? And I was like, why do you want to know my major, right? Weird. And I was like, I'm an engineering student. And he goes, always the engineers. I was like, are you kidding? Like, we're dorks. Like,
what do you say that no matter what you said?
Right, for real. And then, like, I ended up switching my major anyway. I was like, it was hilarious. So, but we were just idiots. But yeah, we would go to these races, and like, so Plattekill ended up being, Plattekill is like a super small little mountain up in upstate New York, and they were one of the first mountains on the East Coast to really start doing a downhill series, mm-hmm. Outside of like the national level races. And so they started doing a collegiate race there. Northeastern out of Boston would actually host their race at Plattekill. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of the best collegiate races ever. In fact, they hosted collegiate nationals one year, doing that event. So, but, you know, you're staying at these like little rinky-dink hotels in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, I was trying to, you know, we're just a bunch of, you know, collegiate kids checking into a hotel with these bikes. And, oh my God, there was this kid, Alex, who was on the UMass team. And I actually saw Alex for the first time since college at Cyclocross World Championships this past January. It's literally been like 22 years since I've seen this guy, and like no time had passed. It was amazing. But so me and like Clayton Harper and Marty pull into this hotel in this little village called Fleischmann's, and everything is like very nice and neat and clean and put together. And Alex is riding his bike around the parking lot with a fire extinguisher strapped to his back, and like he's like blowing the fire extinguisher like it was a jetpack while he was riding his bike around the hotel. And I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And he'd like,
we're here.
Right. Seriously, collegiate cycling has entered the town. And I'm like just mortified thinking back on this right now. You know, but that was kind of how the downhill racing scene was back then. It was totally just a bunch of people who just were looking to, I don't know, I guess have a little bit too much fun maybe, but it was something that enabled us to be able to throw ourselves down a hill on bikes that didn't really work that well. And kind of, it was a formative time for the sport. And so to be a part of that and seeing it evolve and then eventually kind of get in the industry later was a funny time. But man, collegiate cycling is a circus, and we had a good time at UMass for sure.
At this point, were you looking to like really go like world class? Like you had your sights set on the top tier?
Yeah, I was still pretty delusional at the time. Yeah, basically, and I thought that, you know, maybe I could kind of get there, and you know, knowing that like, okay, statistically that path, you have like a few years, you have a few good years kind mm-hmm. of thing. But I knew that those few good years were pretty much coming for me. Mm-hmm. And, I had to kind of like give it a shot if I was ever going to, you know? And so, you know, I was doing the national circuit, racing downhill in Dulsalem. I was, you know, and racing everything I could, like in the Northeast. Iron Horse had put together a team, that was actually managed by somebody who was on the UMass cycling team or previously had been, which is amazing. And so I was invited to be a part of that team. And, and then when I was a senior, I knew I wanted to kind of like try to do something that was bike industry related. So I did an internship at Iron Horse. You know, this is before like almost before email, or like I wasn't on email every day, that's for sure. And there was no smartphones or anything. And this is like winter of 2000, right? And so anyway, Iron Horse gets a phone call, and somehow I got picked to be in the Winter X Games that year. And it was only a couple months away, and I was like totally blown away. They had picked 28 people, and I think the reason they picked me was probably because I was at that year, I happened to be the Eastern Conference downhill champion you know, I don't know, I got lucky that year. There was the Trump whores, there was Clayton Harper, there was Marty, there was like Alex Dunson and Seth Lawley. There was a bunch of fast kids in the Eastern Conference. But I got lucky that year and happened to win the title. And so I don't know if they just wanted a collegiate kid or what. I was the only full-time like student that year in that event in the X Games.
And so Winter X Games. So yeah. What was the event that you were riding in?
Oh, then? Super good question. Yeah. So for whatever reason, in their infinite wisdom, ESPN thought it was a good idea to have 8 mountain bikers at a time race downhill down a border cross course, essentially with like 300 screws in their tires. I guess it made for good TV. I don't know. It didn't really represent the sport per se, but it was something that was like a big event to get into. And so I was like totally honored to be a part of it.
I was gonna say, you must have been pretty stoked. I mean, like, wait, what? Like,
yeah.
This just happened.
Yeah. And the sports marketing department at UMass actually was working directly with ESPN at the time. So like there was a lot of stuff that was happening at UMass that was a part of that Winter X Games that year. Cause Mount Snow is like not far from where UMass is in Western Mass. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of like this, like, you know, hometown underdog, you know, whatever. And I absolutely got smoked. It was like, yeah. I got so crushed, but you know, I made it down the course. And these jumps were like bigger than anything I had jumped before. And you're doing it with like a zip cam following you at the time. Right.
Right.
So you can hear the thing like whirring mm-hmm. while you're like approaching a lip to like a jump that
you can't see the bottom of.
Yeah, for sure. Like out of the start gate, you couldn't see beyond the first lip. Like the world just fell away and you have to sprint at that first lip and jump off. And it was like a step down that was like pretty big step down. It was bigger than anything I had done. And I totally like ate it twice in practice trying to do it. And then like I somehow nailed it in my qualifier and got down the course in one piece and you know, that was about it. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Then like, it, I don't know, they had like Eminem playing or somebody that night in the thing. And I'm like, this is a strange thing we're doing right
yeah,
now.
You know especially what I mean? But, not seeing it coming. And then all of a sudden it's right around the corner. Right.
Oh my God. Right. And I was just trying to like get a job, to be honest with you. I was like a senior at UMass trying to do an internship and like, and it ended up being like, you know, the biggest race I was involved with. I mean, and a lot of the rock stars from that era, and even from today were competing there. I mean, Steve Pete was racing and then there's guys in the industry still like a Joe Lawwell was competing there still. And he's like a marketing guy at Shimano now. So there was like a lot of people like that who were at that event who I met. And again, you know, like the whole snowball effect of the mountain bike scene, you know, like you kind of, you meet these people and then,
Do you ever go back and rewatch that race, the videos with your kid and stuff like that?
Yeah. I have a video of my race run that ESPN sent me on a VHS tape. That's how long ago that was, okay? Like, I mean, like, that's hilarious that that's the format I have that in. But
it's amazing, actually, yeah.
Kind of telling, yeah, right? Yeah. So, but yeah, man. And then, so I was just continuing to want to do the national circuit and as much as I could and just coming to the realization that, you know, I probably should get a job right after school and stuff. And so I moved to Boston, moved in with my college roommate, Jim Sabia in Medford, Mass. I didn't have a job. I had like, he was like, dude, you can stay here for like a couple weeks, but then like, if you can't pay rent, like you need to leave kind of thing. You know what I mean? And I was like, I'm going to find a job. Don't worry about it. And so I started working at a publishing company in Boston, like just for a couple months, just to do design work and stuff. And a couple weeks later, Russell Webb called me. And at the time, he was the kind of the division manager for Maxxis Bike. I was still working with them as like an athlete and stuff at the time.
Had you been working with them all the way through since that first time that you were sending the faxes?
Yeah, I had been. So I just, you know, kept in touch and, you know, stayed grateful. And just every day, you know, every time I talked to them, I would thank them and ask them if I could do anything for them and whatever. And they would send me, like, this is, you talk about my college roommate who like hated all the bikes. So this is before I was living with Jim. I was still like in a dorm at the time, but like a Maxxis pallet of tires would show up. Dude, a pallet of tires would show up in a dorm room and they're like, where are you going to put these? And I'm like, I mean, I don't know. Like they can fit under my bed, right? Like it seemed logical at the time. And you're like, my roommate's like, dude, what are you doing? Right. But
I'm just picturing the smell too. I mean, I love the smell of it, but it's like when you're trapped in 1,000 cubic foot, you know. 10 by 10 by 10.
I'm with you. The beauty of those dorms is that everybody kept the windows open because the heat was cranked so hard.
Right.
So like you had this like airflow that actually worked out. But yeah, it was It was pretty gnarly. So, but Russell Webb called me and was like, hey, you know, we want you to move to Atlanta and we want you to, you know, run what they called racing development. So they wanted somebody who had a UCI license who then could also do the product development piece. And it was like my dream job and he knew it. And you know, basically I was like, I can't move to Atlanta, man. Sorry. Like, I just want to stay in New England. Like, I'm from here. Like, there's mountains here. There's ocean here. Like, the scene that I know is here.
Wow. Yeah.
And, he's like, you're crazy. And I'm like, I know. And I was like, I full on like had a panic attack. I was like, I don't want to live. I don't want to like give up this, you know, opportunity. I have so much like history with this and
you can imagine, yeah, you know, sure.
Kathy was still kind of doing some stuff with Maxis at the time and stuff. And so, out of desperation, I said to them, I'll tell you what, I'm 22 years old. I'll start a consulting company. You will be my only contract, but, I'm going to do it as a contractor and, I'm going to stay in Boston. And, I didn't know anything about this. I had dial up internet. we did not have smartphones. So like, you know, anyway, but for whatever reason, they let me do this. I don't know why.
Yeah.
So, you know, every day I'd like, you know, like the internet, like, you know,
don't pick up the phone. I'm sending an email.
Seriously. Right. And I don't know. Yeah, it was crazy, but we started doing that and I would go to all the Norbos and World Cups in North America and, ride with the athletes on course and then take their feedback and knowing kind of like the language of the athlete and then knowing the language of like how to make product and put those two together. And we created what became the modern day product line for that company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I was a contractor, I had freedom to kind of do other things. So I kind of got into like some real estate stuff and I patented something and, you know, some other stuff, but it always came back to bikes for me. But you know, it was funny, like you're still on the Norba circuit, you're still on the race circuit with like adults now. And it's not collegiate, but it's still pretty like...
But you were still racing competitively at that point as well, or primarily just to test?
It was a little bit of both. Yeah. I wasn't trying to make a name for myself. I realized that my place really was this, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think, you know, I could have had a moment where I was like defeated or whatever and just saying, okay, like I'm not going to be like a World Cup champion, right? But I took it as an opportunity to basically say like, this is actually better for me. It's more longevity. Like this is, I think, a better fit anyway. And, you know, I have, for whatever reason, I don't even know how this even came to be, but like, I just like drawing stuff, you know? And so like it came out in that way and it just, the universe was talking to me and it kind of worked. So anyway, so through that, I was working at Maxis and Maxis was like starting to kind of tail off. I had a 10-year run with them. I had 2 5-year contracts and it was a great experience. And, you know, we did a lot of things there, but I knew I was going to do something else. And so, you know, before I came to Vitoria, I went to the ski show with Bo Lambert out in Colorado. And, I had this idea for ski wax that was like, environmentally friendly ski wax, because a lot of ski wax is pretty toxic and stuff. And so I had kind of formulated this product and we had a distributor for it and all that stuff. And we ended up selling the company, but Bo and I went to the ski show for 1 year. so this is kind of funny. So we're staying at my buddy's house in Colorado. And, so he's like, dude, I know you guys are like, you know, coming in here with like no budget, trying to like you get this company started and whatever. And, so you can stay at my place and I have a car you can use, don't rent a car, you know, whatever. And my buddy was like he was like attorney, like for the state or something like official. And so I was like, all right, that's cool. And so, you know, we go to the show and we go out to this dinner with the distributor and stuff. And we're like coming home. And, now this guy lives in like across the state. So it was like nowhere near where this dinner was. And so we had like a couple hour drive to get back. And so I didn't drink anything at dinner because I was like, you know, paranoid about like having to drive my buddy's car and the whole thing and just being safe. And at the time, like, okay, like now I had like met my now wife and like, I had a, you know, like, you know, all these kind of responsibilities, but, and Bo did too. Right. So we were being responsible, but anyway, so we're in the middle of nowhere, totally pitch dark, like, you know, like in a prairie somewhere.
and we go through a speed trap. This is like, and I wasn't even speeding, but like apparently I was. I didn't even know. Anyway, I think I was going like 65 and a 55 or something like this. And the cop's like, you know this car's not registered, right? And I'm like,
no, I don't.
So yeah, I do now. So he's, and I'm like, oh my God, it's my buddy's car. And he's like, let me get this straight. You don't have, you're from out of state. So you flew here yesterday. You're driving a car that's not yours, that's not registered, and you're speeding. And Bo's like, we're screwed. He's like, they're going to impound the car. And I'm like, oh my God, how are we going to get home? Right. And somehow the cop gave me a ticket and that was it. Didn't impound the car, was going to let us drive it home. I don't even understand.
Wow. How. Yeah. Yeah. That's super lucky. Right.
So like me and Bo are like hyperventilating. We're in, you know, and the cop pulls away and we pull away. And it's just like silence. And like, like
our, that just happened.
Yeah. Our eyes are like wide open. And Bo's like, dude, it's hot in here. I gotta open the windows. And he opens the window and the ticket flies out on the highway. So like, oh, like, dude. So
in the pitch black, so you just like run after it.
Right. Right. So I'm like, I don't know where this ticket went. Right. So this is really bad now. So we get back to my buddy's house and he's like, how'd it go? And I'm like, well, funny story. Again, this guy works for the state, right? So he's mortified. He's like, I can't believe this. I'm so sorry, whatever. And I'm like, oh my God. And we lost the ticket already. I don't even know where it is. So I had to call the state and retell the whole story. The lady's on the other line like, are you kidding me right now? And they had to reissue the ticket. And then, oh my God, the whole thing. But we made it through it. Me and Bo are still buddies to this day. And he's still doing big things. And at that point, I was kind of like, all right, I'm going to get back into the bike thing. And, you know, I approached Vittoria about actually making my own tire line. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what Vittoria does is making tires for other brands. Vittoria has, you know, the highest quality control in the industry. And I knew that if I wanted something to have my name on it, I wanted it to come out of their factory. So I approached them, and at the time, I didn't know this, but they were planning on opening an office in Boston.
Oh, right on, yeah.
Like, dumb luck. Yeah, right, totally, yeah. And so I feel like I've really been lucky a few times in this whole path, and this was definitely one of those times. And they said, well, you know, we could make your own line for you, or why don't you just come work for us and, like, revamp our whole off-road line? And I was like, that's a thing? Like, this job wasn't, like, advertised, you know? It wasn't, like, a... But... you know, they knew kind of my prior portfolio from what I had done elsewhere and stuff. And so, yeah, I joined and I've been at Vittoria for 11 years now. And
so what's your capacity there now then?
So, I started as like a brand manager for their off-road, categories. And, now, I'm the senior vice president of product development globally there. Yeah. I really just draw pictures and talk about it.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. I mean, let's be real.
In layman's terms. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like it's,
I was wondering, so you're still actually designing and sketching and
yeah. So like
ideas in the middle of the night.
Yeah. I mean, as I did when I was that high school kid in study hall, I mean, yeah. I still just draw pictures and dream and, you know, talk to athletes and make cool product. And now it's obviously, you know, there's more metrics involved, of course, but a whole lot more technology involved. I mean, what we've done on the tread design aspect has been one thing, but just compounds, we use, you know, we're the first company to use graphene in the compound. And I was a part of that team. And so that makes the compound last longer and grip better and roll faster than mm-hmm. it did before. Casing technologies are evolving, and I'm just gonna leave that one there because there's some stuff going on there. And okay. But yeah, I mean, there's big things happening at Vittoria, and so it's been really fun to be a part of that whole process for the last 11 years.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, and so forward looking, I mean, it seems like almost that serendipity keeps playing a role in like your next steps. Yeah. Do you even want to think like where you might be in another 10 or 20 years from now? Or do you just want to like let it roll on and just see what comes at you? Or,
you know, there's a piece of me that just like, I'm so lucky to do what I do and to have what I have. And, you know, I've been able to like have a family, and support like a lifestyle, you know, with bikes. It's unbelievable to think about that. There's a piece of me that wonders if like, how many times can you get lucky? Yeah, right. Yeah, like, yeah. Can this really happen forever? But then there's another piece of me that just feels like, you know, as you grow and you meet people and opportunities go by you every day. And it's just a matter of getting better at seeing it, you know, and as you see these opportunities happening and, you know, like I do every single day, you know, and I was in a meeting before you came here today, you know, we were talking about some opportunities that are happening that could really be beneficial for our brand and for our projects, you know, and that would help real riders. And I think as long as you keep it real in terms of like helping people and helping people have more fun, helping people reach their goals, that's what drives me in that way. Maybe that's the best answer for that first question you asked me. You know, I ride bikes because I want to help people and reach their goals and have fun. And so, I mean, as long as you keep doing that, I think the luck will continue and, you know, I'm hopeful that it will.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some people might call it karma or something like that, but I think that as long as what you touched on with keeping your eyes open, sort of keeping your mind open to everything that come along and sort of just go with how your gut is. I mean, one of the examples which I picked up on is you don't want to go to Atlanta. You want to do this thing, but you need to follow what your gut is telling you, have a major anxiety attack about it, and then it works out. So, you know, if you'd sort of given into that anxiety attack. I have to go to Georgia because this is an opportunity that I can't pass up. Who knows where you would be? And it might have gone a whole different path, you know, and you might not be talking about the luck that continues, you know? So
no, absolutely. I mean, you know, staying in Boston, you know, I met Nate Brown. He introduced me to, you know, Rachel and who's my wife. And because of that, we were able to form a life here in New England that we wanted. And then, you know, it's like, I can't even believe I have a teenager, dude. It's like, I still act like a teenager half the time, but I mean, you know, I ride bikes with my family around New England now. And it's because of bikes. Honestly, none of this would have happened without bikes. And that's why I ride a bike.
Fantastic. Well, I feel like that's probably a good spot to sort of end this then, right? Does that feel all right?
I think so.
So before I let you go, though, or before I let myself leave your house, is there anybody you want to say hi out there to, or anything you want to plug?
Yeah, man, I want to plug New England Youth Cycling. I think it's really rad that we have almost 1,000 kids this year in this league. You know, my daughter's in her third year racing. She's met a ton of friends. I think the future is bright for kids who are, you know, looking to find a place in sports and in life and who love being outside and have that sense of adventure. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity if you're listening and you know somebody who's into that, please go check it out. Come to an event, come say hi and just get outside and ride your bike.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody you want to say hi to?
Of course, I want to say hi to my daughter, Tessa, and my wife, Rachel, and all my friends in Amherst. You know, otherwise, you know, my people at Vitoria, thank you so much for listening to me on a daily basis and, all my buddies who, you know, put up with me in the downhill circuit back in the day. So that's about it.
Yeah, and for the cop that let you go that time.
And thank you for the cop who let me go after not impounding the car both times. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for your time. This is super great to meet you today and sit down and talk about your history with bikes and your love of bikes and how it's sort of guided your life in a very positive, happy way. So I'd love to see it. If anybody out there wants to have some stories you want to share, please send me an email. You can find me at iRideABike.com and follow along on Instagram or Facebook at iRideABike. And until next time, ride safe and ride happy.
Thanks. Thanks, man.
Take me back to the times when we would grab our bikes and ride the days into the night. Though our eyes would soon be open for the moment we were golden.
This has been a production of iRide LLC. For more information, please visit iRideABike.com. Theme song by Spencer Albee. Want to hear more? Enter @SpencerAlbee on socials and streaming platforms.